We know that Justice Department reviews of several police departments, Chicago, Baltimore, Ferguson, concluded that there were huge racial disparities. Blacks disproportionately stopped, shot, arrested. In Ferguson, officials talked openly about using blacks as a source of revenue, with an impossible-to-pay system of fines that sent even the least offenders to prison. But in his new book, MSNBC's Chris Hayes, who is white, makes the case that there isn't one justice system with disparities. There are two. The nation, the policing most whites experience, and the colony, the justice system minorities experience. What, Hayes writes, you'd expect in an occupied land. Whites are more aware now of how in the crack epidemic in the 80s, black addicts were shipped off to prison by the thousands. In today's largely white opioid epidemic, there's a compassionate move to treat them instead. That when black neighborhoods racked by violence asked for jobs and a way to stop the flow of guns, they got militarily armed SWAT teams instead. But Hayes compares many black neighborhoods today, where men like Eric Garner sell illegal cigarettes to get by, to the colonies under the thumb of the British, where smugglers like John Hancock kept the economy going with illegal molasses to make rum. Chris Hayes' book is A Colony in a Nation. He joins us now. Chris, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just start with that comparison to colonial America. You say Eric Garner, who we remember put in a chokehold, choked by a police officer in 2014. His last words before I can't breathe were, "Every time you see me, you want to mess with me. It stops today." You say that could have been spoken to the colonial customs officers who hauled in smugglers. Tell us more about this comparison.
You know, we think about the American Revolution as fought over taxes, taxation without representation. But that's actually a bit misleading because at the time, most of the taxes were collected as import tariffs, and they were collected and enforced through essentially policing actions. And what happens in the lead up to the revolution is that the crown decides they need more revenue and they start cracking down on smuggling. Smuggling is the lifeblood of the colonies at that point. And they inaugurate what I call in the book the first era of stop and frisk. Ships pulled over with no notice, boarded, all sorts of merchants harassed and humiliated. And it is that experience of policing, I mean specifically policing, that is much of what raises the temperature of revolutionary fervor. You have mobs chasing customs officers down the street, tarring and feathering them. You even have in the Declaration of Independence itself, Thomas Jefferson in his Bill of Particulars, Complaints Against the Crown, says the following: "He hath sent forth swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out our substance." Mm-hmm. Now, think about that. That is the complaint that Eric Garner had. It's the complaint that so many people today have.
But I can hear people saying, but wait a second, there's a difference between a colony that's being ruled from afar by the British and everyone in this country who is a citizen is expected to follow the laws.
Right. Obviously, there's a big difference, right? We have democratic representation, and I'm not saying that we are like the crown. The point of the colony metaphor is to try to cultivate in readers the sense of the subjective experience of the power of the state feeling external, feeling unaccountable, feeling like an occupation. And so the subjective experience of how a lot of people in this country experience policing is like that, even if the political structures are different in some important ways. You know, breaking the law or following the law is not the end of a conversation. It's the beginning of one. I say this all the time when I'm talking to people about immigration. They say they broke the law. And I say to them, have you ever broken the law? Mm-hmm. And the answer, if anyone's honest, always is yes.
Talk a little bit about that, because as soon as you start pulling up this window shade, this curtain, as soon as you have a little bit of insight, you start to see, for instance, how you were able to go to one of the conventions. I think it was the Republican convention in 2000, and you had some marijuana in your bag and you got through. You were in a college dorm sitting with a bunch of kids completely stoned, passing a bong around, and the security guy walks in and says he likes the music you're playing. You are aware that that would not be the case if you were black.
Right. I mean, I've had, you know, I've not had very many brushes with the law, but I have had some in the campus cop in my college and then in the Republican convention with Philly cops going through my bag as I went through a checkpoint and finding about $30 worth of weed in there. You know, in both cases, I think there's a judgment made about whether to pursue the law or to let it go. And what I think is important to think about this story isn't just the kind of double standard. It isn't just the sort of ways in which people from different backgrounds, demographically, racially, get treated differently by the system, but also the fact that it is the case that the frontline officer has a tremendous amount of both latitude and authority in enforcing the law. And in some ways, it has to be that way. It is such a difficult job. It requires so many minute judgment calls. You wouldn't want to overly prescribe what they have to do in every situation because things are so kinetic and unpredictable. But at the same time, it is in that authority and latitude that so much of the kind of inequities of the system can come to rest. You see that when you're out reporting on this, and you see it when you experience it firsthand in the kind of benevolent versions that I did. I mean, I think that one of the things that you see is that there is a kind of cloak of suspicion that attaches to blackness. And obviously, that's not a new or novel observation. But it is very much bound up with a concept of order. You know, law and order is this phrase. The two words sort of run together. You don't think of them as separate entities. Richard Nixon ran on law and order. Our current president really hammered it home in his own convention speech. And what I think is so potent about the concept is it's much more, it turns out, about order than it is about law. Mm. What you end up when you call for law and order is a system that seeks to preserve a certain kind of social order. And I think we saw that in the ways in which American society and politics responded to the great crime wave that happened roughly from the late 60s to the early 90s. We're seeing it now in many ways applied to immigration. People talk about immigrants breaking the law, but in a kind of deep neurotic sense, what's driving people is a sense of disorderliness, that the social order is coming unraveled and has to be preserved.
Well, you mentioned Nixon, and you talk about how lawmakers knew that they had to change their language to kind of fit that need to hear that there was going to be law and order. And you quote Lee Atwater saying, you know, in 1954, you could say the N-word. In 1968, you couldn't say that. So you had to say other stuff like states' rights and law and order.
That's right. The language becomes more attenuated and more coded. And this word order packs a very specific rhetorical punch because it speaks to what to me is in some ways the dominant through line of American history, the most powerful emotional fuel of American politics, which is white fear. It's the fear of things coming unraveled at the hands of some other that begins from the very moment the very first ship to settle Jamestown lands on the banks of the shores and the captain writes in his diary, we were attacked by the savages. And it runs right through the crack years of New York City and right through today.
And it's something you're sympathetic to. You're very honest. First of all, when it comes to police, you take one of those drills where you're shown videos and what would you do? Would you pull your gun? Well, you're pulling your gun a lot, you know, in cases that
it's amazing how quickly you go to it.
Shooting all over the place. And also growing up in a neighborhood in which you had to walk through, you are white again, and you had to walk through black neighborhoods. And you admit to having that fear.
100%. I mean, I think part of the – look, a big part of this book is I am trying to figure out why did we build this? And by we, I mean – white people. By we, I mean democratic citizens of the United States. It wasn't just white people. In fact, there's a bit in the book that uses some of the great work from James Forman, who's got a book out about the kind of politics of crime in predominantly black and brown areas. But that said, yes, I felt it. I feel it. I feel the allure of order. I feel the sort of tingly sensation in the brainstem of the fear of the other. Those are things that we are given by our inheritance as citizens of this country, as white citizens of this country. The point isn't to feel guilty about it or to think that it's some monstrous entity. The question is how is that channeled and whether you recognize it for what it is. And part of the project of this book is to say to people like, you know, yeah, of course there's the allure of that. Of course there's mm-hmm. some sense in which someone comes to us promising that if some set of people can be contained within the colony, if they can be controlled, then you can live free and flourish, that is a tempting bargain to be offered. It's not a ridiculous idea that there's a temptation there.
Yeah. Well, the end result of colonizing, if we take your theory, is, of course, go back to the early colonists. If you keep the metaphor going, then what do you think we're looking at?
I think that there is no more powerful an underappreciated force in human affairs and politics than the experience of humiliation. I think humiliation is so powerful because it can't be acted on. It stores up and then it explodes. You know, the precipitating incident of the The Arab Spring was a fruit vendor in Tunisia being humiliated by a cop. And some of the precipitating incidents of our own revolution. So there is a lot of pent-up humiliation. And I don't know where it goes. I think we've seen sort of expressions of rebellion in the face of it, Black Lives Matter and other associated movements. And I don't know where it goes next. And we have a system now that we're at the sort of decision point about whether we're going to close the vice further or start to open it up and rethink it. And I think a lot depends on what we do.
Chris Hayes, MSNBC host, author of the new book, A Colony in a Nation. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you. I had a great time.
And by the way, when it comes to policing, Chris also says he thinks we ask too much of our police. We ask them to be social workers, mental health experts. And he talks a lot about his own reporting experience, having his face pressed to the ground, taking cover from gunfire while covering rioting in Ferguson, realizing in that moment both sides, police and protesters, don't know where the gunfire is coming from. It is a great read.